I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today on The Larry Mueller Show, and we're taking you up and down the mighty Mississippi River this hour with our guest, the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine, Reggie McLeod. The July-August issue is out now, and the big headline to start it all off on the cover is, "We did it!" exclamation mark. We'll find out more about that, as well as some of the other stories in this current issue of Big River Magazine, along with your help, your questions, and your Mississippi River stories along the way. Let us know what you love about the Mississippi, or why you call the Driftless region home and would welcome everybody else to visit. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, talk@wpr.org. And Reggie, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
Well, thank you. Good morning, Lee.
Yeah, and I understand some changes are underway at Big River Magazine, and that has to do with the big "We Did It" on the cover of the July-August issue.
Yes, we started about 32 and a half years ago, and this current issue is the first one that's published as a nonprofit. We've become a nonprofit magazine as of May. So that's a big, we've been working at it for 2.5 years. So it's not like a shock, but it is a big change in terms of how we organize and our goals and that sort of thing.
Congratulations are in order, Reggie, but what does this mean for Big River Magazine going forward?
Well, I used to be the sole boss here, and now we have a board of directors of 5 people up and down the river, actually. It's a great group with a lot of expertise in a variety of areas. And we have some big goals. We want to create an online database with all of the back issues in a searchable format.
Sure.
This is the 240th issue, the current one, and there's a lot of good resources there on history and critters and environmental issues and so on. We also want to do more investigative pieces, perhaps get some grant or funding that will allow us to do that. Hmm. And also, we want to resume having public meetings up and down the river. Before COVID, we would have usually about 4 meetings during the winter and get people together and ask them about local river issues and answer questions about what we're doing and just kind of talk about the river and things.
Sure, and get some ideas for some stories or maybe a few authors and photojournalists that might be interested in contributing.
That too. Some of our longtime writers are people that we met at these gatherings.
Yeah.
So it'll be great to get out there again.
So you mentioned that this Big River magazine goes back more than 30 years now, but it didn't begin as a magazine, right? It just started as a little old newsletter at the start of 1993.
Yeah. I don't think of it as a little old newsletter, but yeah, the first.
Just saying, it's come a long way.
Yes, it has. The first few issues were just 6 pages, and I kind of saw it as something that would be useful for river professionals. And at the time, I'd been working as a freelancer. I worked for a lot of different publications through the 80s into the early 90s. And it kind of evolved and grew, and around 2000, we started having color in the magazine, which makes the photos look a lot more interesting, and having advertisements, which are, I'm proud to say, are mostly small, locally owned businesses in the Driftless area, which is the stretch of river we cover. And we've grown since then, slowly.
Oh, indeed. And so the July-August issue is out now, and it starts with the big news that Big River Magazine's now published by a nonprofit called Big River Voice. And it's a transition to a not-for-profit publishing system. And Reggie, now you've got a board of directors to answer to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I'm on the board of directors.
Okay.
So I get a voice. We have Terry Goodman down in Dubuque, who helped start the Big River Museum down there, and she worked for the city of Dubuque and has really helped start up a number of different nonprofit river organizations over the years. And one of our news editor, actually, who lives down in Sebula, Iowa, and Galena, Illinois, she's kind of back and forth. She's on the board of directors. We have John Sullivan, who was working for the Wisconsin DNR for many years. He was in charge of water quality in the stretch of the Mississippi River that borders Wisconsin. And we have Ron Cruz up in the Twin Cities, who originally was a journalist, but he started a couple nonprofits that have to do with environmental issues. And the last job he had before he retired was he was the head of the Mississippi River program for the McKnight Foundation up in Minneapolis. So we've got a lot of depth in this board. It's pretty exciting. It's really good to have the help from all these people who know a lot of things that I don't know. So.
Well, it sounds to me, Reggie, as though you have organized a group of stewards for the Mississippi River as your board of directors for the Big River magazine.
Yes, broadly speaking, that's what we do. We focus on journalism, covering the area, hoping that that will help the health of the river and the communities in this stretch from the Twin Cities down to the Quad Cities.
Yeah, and you mentioned one of your board members focusing on water quality, and your recent new issue of Big River Magazine, the July-August issue, has a story about a new 10-year water quality plan that came from the Mississippi Watershed Management Organization.
Yeah, that's an organization that in Minnesota, it's a formal, and I think there may be these in other states, but it's a formal organization that takes care of the runoff for a certain area. And this particular organization is on the upstream end of the Twin Cities. And, you know, they spent decades and billions of dollars building storm sewers to get the water into the river as quickly as possible. And that's carried a lot of pollution into the river, soil and fertilizers and motor oil and various things. And now they're spending millions of dollars keeping that stuff out of the Mississippi River and getting it so that more of the rain soaks into the ground as it should. And that will improve the water quality of the Mississippi River at the same time. So they've done a lot of big projects up there. One of the big ones was the golf course. But they've changed a lot of streets and a lot of buildings. The runoff from parking lots and the buildings themselves go into ponds and slowly infiltrate into the groundwater. And they also support, you know, trees and kind of a rain garden. It's these rain gardens and just contouring the land, changing. They even have storm sewers now that basically leak. So they have junctions that they bury where several storm sewers come together, and the water can, if they get a big rush of water, it fills up that container, and then it's some of it slowly infiltrates down into the soil. So they're working on a lot of innovative things up there in the city.
One of my big takeaways from that story was just how dirty that upper Mississippi River water used to be because of how we would see it as just a place to flush everything away.
Oh, yeah. Below the Twin Cities, from the Twin Cities all the way down to Lake Pepin, there were virtually no fish. It was basically dead. There were surveys in the early 20th century where they would find one or two fish in that whole stretch of the river. And now there's really excellent smallmouth bass fishing in the Twin Cities. That's a big deal up there now. And however, there are still issues. They don't eat the bass up there because there's PFAS and, you know, some other pollution problems up in that stretch. But a lot of the waste that went into the river, and actually, you know, a lot of the runoff now is not going in there, and that's helped it improve steadily. In fact, they had sewer systems there that when they had a heavy rain, the storm sewers mixed up with the sewage system.
Yeah.
So they fixed that back in the 90s, in the 1990s. It's kind of late, yeah.
Not that long ago where it's not something worth remembering. And it also drives home the value of organizations like the Mississippi Watershed Management Organization, which you feature in the current issue of your magazine, because this water quality focus would not have happened in large part without them. And we're still dealing with these things today, as your magazine talks about 3M looking to deal with PFAS runoff into the Big River.
Yeah, they've rerouted a creek that used to run through a landfill that had PFAS in it. So they decided, they invested doing a detour around the landfill. And this creek eventually, you know, its water ends up in the Mississippi River, too. In fact, that's one of the first places where they found a lot of PFAS, was in the kind of the lower end of the Mississippi in the Twin Cities, down around Cottage Grove and upstream of Hastings and that.
So the water quality issues persist, and the organizations that look towards creating a 10-year plan of keeping it clean remain up. I would argue would remain important in water quality along the Mississippi.
Oh, yes. And all of these watershed organizations kind of plan in 10-year increments. But some of the cooler things I think they're doing is they're daylighting creeks in some of them. So with these creeks, of course, they spent millions of dollars turning into storm sewers. They're trying to open them up so that there are creeks again on the surface. Hmm. And so their wildlife can live there, and they're connecting. Some of them run out of lakes, so you could actually connect the Mississippi River to a lake via a creek that has been a storm sewer for 100 years. So, yeah, it's pretty interesting, but it's interesting because we're kind of going back to the way things were, to a degree. Of course, where the creeks are a lot cleaner than they were 100 years ago, too. So,
but the way you explain it, Reggie, also makes it sound like the main artery that runs the blood through the heart of this country.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like a living organism, the way you explain it, and the desire to keep that running clean and free. I kind of appreciate the analogy. Reggie McLeod is our guest. He is the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine, with a July-August issue out now. And also looking for your stories along the mighty Mississippi or the Driftless region, and what you have to share or questions you might have for Reggie, perhaps some story ideas for the future Big River Magazine itself. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Stay with us after noon today as we talk about aging gracefully and how to care for your mental health as you get older. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today on The Larry Mueller Show, and right now we're talking about the newest issue of Big River Magazine, out now, and some of the stories you'll find in it, some of the pictures, and an invitation for you to make some suggestions about what you'd like to see or hear in a Big River Magazine in the future. 1-800-642-1234 is a number to join us. That's 800-642-1234, and let's go to Lyric in Madison. Lyric, good morning.
Good morning. I'm so delighted to hear Reggie on today. I'm a second-generation subscriber of Big River Magazine, and I own a cottage in Crawford County on the Big River Road. So it belonged to my great-grandfather and recently come into my property, and we have a big stack of Big River Magazines on the table.
Oh, awesome.
In our cottage, and we look out over Highway 35 and the railroad tracks and the National Wildlife Refuge that's right there. And I really, really appreciate the work of Big River, and your publication has really expanded my connection to different opportunities in the area, and to different agencies that are doing good work on the river. And I'm really excited about the idea of having that digital archive of all of your previous issues. So just wanted to thank you very much for your great work, Reggie.
Lyric, great. Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Lyric, you're in Crawford County, you mentioned. I wanted to ask you about the closure of the Black Hawk Bridge and what you've seen there, if anything, so far.
Well, you know, I've just I've just, driven by it and around it, but...
Yeah, out of commission
until
2027. And Reggie, you write about it in Big River, this issue of Big River Magazine. But it's not the only bridge closure around us across the Mississippi right now.
No, that's true. But it is an unfolding story, actually. There's things, a lot of things happening with it. But the bridge in Clinton, one of the bridges in Clinton, Iowa, is closed between Clinton and Fulton, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
There are two of them, and this is for routine deck maintenance. And fortunately, they have two bridges. Generally, the bridges are spaced about 30 miles apart on the river, and with the exception, notable exception, of between Prairie du Chien and Dubuque. There's a Cassville Ferry, which is where perhaps a bridge should be, and the town of Cassville and Guttenberg, too, to a degree, have been kind of lobbying for a bridge there. But, when the bridge is closed at Lansing, it's going to be really rough on a lot of people and on the businesses in town. You know, there are teachers and, all kinds of people who work on one side and live on the other side.
Sure.
They're used to having that bridge. And, it was closed this summer, then it reopened, and now they're going to close it again. They're going to tear it down in September now, which is pretty dramatic. One of the things that we want to write about in the next issue, September, is, and I don't have the numbers at hand, but a lot of people don't realize that most of the Mississippi River bottom is, 100 or more feet of sand and gravel underneath. The bedrock is way, way, way down there, hundreds of feet in places. And the footings for that Black Hawk Bridge are relatively shallow. And I wish I could tell you the exact depth, but when they build bridges today, they make those footings a lot deeper. And they'll have the new bridge done, and they started the new bridge a couple of years ago. But that has much deeper footings, and, it's wider and safer, in a lot of ways. But that Black Hawk Bridge, the footings have been shifting, and the work driving the footings in deeper on the new bridge has been affecting the shallower footings on the old bridge, and that's happening. And, you just can't, especially since the accident up in the Twin Cities back in 2007, 13 people died when that bridge collapsed. They just can't take chances with bridges. So, but that's going to be tough. They have a water taxi there now kind of standing by. That they used earlier in the summer when the bridge closed for a while. And they're trying to arrange a ferry that can carry cars back and forth, which, of course, doesn't work in the winter, but it would work, maybe half the year. But there aren't a lot of, good ferry boats sitting around waiting. you can't go to a used boat place and buy a ferry boat. So that might be difficult to do, but I hear that they're working pretty hard to try to get a ferry there.
Well, and it makes me wonder about the condition of some of the older bridges along the Mississippi and when those might have to look towards repair or being rebuilt.
Yeah, well, they really ramped up, so to speak, they ramped up the inspections after the bridge collapse in Minneapolis. And I know the Winona Bridge here by where I live is, they were inspecting it, and this is a month or two after the bridge collapsed up there. And one of the inspectors was tapping on a rivet, and when the paint, there were several layers of paint, that collapsed, and there was no rivet there. So the paint was shaped like the head of a rivet, but that rivet underneath the paint had long ago rusted out. So when she did that, she went to her boss, and they put up the blockades right that instant. They didn't call anybody or anything. They just stopped all the traffic. And that caused some chaos around here for a while. And they did build a new bridge, but after that opened, they fixed up the old bridge. So we have two bridges now.
So you suspect more stories to come about the bridge in Black Hawk Bridge in Crawford County?
Well, it'll be, they haven't, as far as I know, they haven't said when the old bridge is coming down.
Yeah.
And the new bridge, they're saying, will be done in 2007. I mean, it takes a long time to build a bridge now. And I have a feeling the engineers are looking at ways they might be able to speed that up. And I don't know if they're going to, they kind of move along it as fast as they can anyway. But I'll bet they're having meetings about that now, because that's going to be a big gap for, you know, 2 years
right.
not having a bridge.
Between now and 2027. Let's go to Tom and Nina next. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm glad to hear about the water quality improvements in the Mississippi River. And we also understand the Hexagenia mayfly is an important aquatic organism in the Mississippi River. And in the 70s, it had been basically wiped out down to Winona from the metropolitan area of St. Paul and Minneapolis. Unfortunately, though, now that, you know, after the mayflies have recovered, there's evidence again that there are new forms of pollutants that are beginning to decimate the mayfly populations again in the Mississippi River. So we have to be diligent about causes of pollution, and the current hypothesis is that it's probably from the agribusinesses in the pesticides that are being used, but it would be a terrible thing to lose the Hexagenia bilineata population of mayflies in the Mississippi River.
What would be the domino effect of that as you see it, Tom?
It would fish rely on the birds, the fishermen, and just the aesthetics to lose an organism like that that's so iconic and representative of the Mississippi River. It would just be a terrible sin to have occur.
Tom, thank you. And certainly an idea, Reggie, about the Hexagenia mayfly and its threatened population along the Mississippi.
Yeah, insects in general are in decline, and part of it, a lot of people are pointing to neonicotinoids, which is a new class of insecticides that are very potent and persistent, and that kills all the insects. They're a good insect. I mean, we define this. All the insects have a purpose in the big plan, but we define good insects and bad insects, and the huge majority of insects are good insects. And birds have to eat insects for part of their life. Even hummingbirds have to eat insects because when birds are raising their young, they need protein. They're not looking for carbohydrates or sugar. They need protein to feed the babies. And so they can grow so quickly and migrate or whatever. And as the insects decline, the birds, the populations have declined a lot. And we had a story a couple issues ago about trout streams, and they're starting to see declines of some of the insects in trout streams because these neonicotinoids are everywhere. And in some places, before you can introduce a new chemical into the environment, it has to be tested and approved. And in the U.S., you start using it, and sometimes decades later, like PFAS, they were manufacturing PFAS starting in the early 50s, and here just a few years ago, everyone goes, wow, it's everywhere, and it's probably killing people. It's in the drinking water in a lot of places, and I don't know.
Yeah, we don't know what it's doing so far. We're still yet to figure it out. We've let loose the PFAS without understanding them completely, and now it seems to be quite ubiquitous. I absolutely see that. But you're talking about these birds requiring protein and needing insects at some point in their life as part of their food cycle and diet. And hands down, the best bird pictures in this Big River Magazine issue, the July-August issue, Reggie McLeod, has to be Tom Watson's as he takes a wildlife viewing from a kayak up and down a river of ways there. And he's got a story to go with it. But the photos he got, I think, are something special and need to be seen.
Yep, I agree. That's a fun story. Mm. And, you know, when you're out on the river in the water and you're in a motorboat, it's a whole different river than when you're in a canoe or a kayak. And there are a lot of places you can go to in a canoe and kayak where you really can't get to in a motorboat. And Tom writes a story about that and just how you can kind of drift up on animals, and sometimes they'll just look at you. 'Cause they're, you know, they don't hear anything. They're not sure what that is. And I found that actually on a bicycle and bike trails a couple of times. I've biked really early in the morning, got out right at sunrise, and I've gone right by deer where I could reach out and touch them.
Wow.
If I wanted to. I didn't want to startle them. But the same is true on the river. It's really nice. You can kind of back a canoe or a kayak back into some rushes or cattails sometimes and just kind of watch things. And Tom does a great job about talking about that and some of the experiences he's had where he's been surprised. Once a deer ran across a floodplain forest and jumped in the water right in front of him, and he watched it swim across the channel there. And
do you call a group of white pelicans a flock of pelicans? I'm trying to think what this is, but it's got to be at least 36 pelicans all grouped together on a little body of water here that I'm looking at.
I'm pretty sure they're called something else, and I'm pretty sure I don't know what it is, Lee. Maybe a raft.
A raft of pelicans makes sense because they're so close together. You could probably float on it.
Might be something else. Well, one of the really cool things about the pelicans up here, you know, the ones that you see down in the seacoast are individuals, the gray pelicans, and these white pelicans really hunt in groups, and they will actually drive fish into shallow water and then go and feed in the fish, and they talk and to each other in pelican language, of course. But also they do a thing called kettling, where they'll be up in the air and they'll fly around in a circle, and I've seen that over La Crosse, over downtown La Crosse, over downtown Winona, in different places. And a lot of times early in the morning they'll do this, and it's like a big column of pelicans, and there might be like 30 or 40 pelicans.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they'll leave in like two or three groups sometimes and go in entirely different directions. And it's almost as if they're having a little meeting up there and deciding what they're going to do. That they're really fun to watch, and they're huge. I mean, you can't really see it in this picture, or even when you see them flying, but I think they have like 8-foot wingspans or something like that. They're huge birds.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, there's something you would see solitary in the south, but here they seem to be working in cahoots.
Yeah, they're very communal. And it's a different species, you know, it's a different species. But sometimes I've been out fishing in the backwaters, you know, and sometimes you want one more cast and it starts to get dark. And the pelicans, I've seen, you know, groups of pelicans flying in and landing and all kind of congregating in the same area from different directions, you know. So I think they have quite a social life, actually.
That is very cool. And you can see that in the beautiful pictures from Tom Watson in this issue of the Big River magazine. And as long as we're talking about what the birds eat, we might as well talk about what we eat as well, because your new issue of the magazine, Reggie, has a one-of-a-kind restaurant experience in the Driftless region, a farm-to-table French restaurant that was an old church?
No, they built the church.
They built the church. It looks like an old church.
It's a hermitage. Monks and nuns, largely, many of them are French. And, yeah, it's a beautiful little church. And it's over between Soldiers Grove and Gay's Mills, which is a little out of the way in terms of, you know, you hear people say build a restaurant, you got to think of three things: location, location, and location.
But these guys thought if we build it, they will come. So
they are coming. Yeah, and it was great fun. It's just half the fun is driving there. Actually, it's such a beautiful area. Mm-hmm. But the two nuns that were serving in the dining room are both French, and It took a long time to have dinner. Nobody's in a hurry. Don't go there if you're in a hurry. But it was really charming. The food was excellent. I had monkfish for the first time in my life.
And oh, wow.
I'm going to have it again. I'm looking forward to it. And, oh, boy, the desserts and, you know, baked goods are exquisite. It's
called the St. Francis Hermitage. It's east of Gay's Mills, and it's an organic farm-to-table French restaurant that actually has French nun and clergy as part of the staff?
Yeah, monks and nuns. And they actually grow a lot of the food and put it up, preserve it, and process it, and things like that.
Do we know where this idea came from? It's such a neat, out-of-the-way destination sort of experience that, again, it's one of a kind that I wouldn't have found otherwise.
Well, you know, hermitages used to, in the old days, you know, they were self-supporting. So, a duke or a count or something would give some land to the church, and a bunch of monks or nuns would go out there, and they'd build houses, and they'd grow their own food and make their own wine or beer. And I had to think of that. And you know, they were self-sufficient. They would basically be self-sufficient. And they're still doing that in some places. There are a few places along the river. There's a group, and I'm not going to remember all the names. There's a group of monks on the bluff above Dubuque, and there's a St. Francis Center by La Crosse, and there's another one on the Minnesota side between Winona and La Crosse where nuns have a hermitage. So and they don't, you know, they don't have a big presence. This is the only place I know of that has a restaurant. The place in La Crosse has a lot of programs and classes and things like that, but some of them are very you know, you hardly know they're there. They're praying and you know, living a religious life, and that's their whole purpose there. So
the St. Francis Hermitage, put it on your map and make sure you find it in the new issue of Big River Magazine right now. Our guest is the editor and publisher, Reggie McLeod, and want to take a moment to invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Share your Mississippi River stories, your favorite spots in the drift list, or what you'd like to see in future issues of Big River Magazine. Talk at WPR.org is also an acceptable way to get a hold of us anytime, anyway. You have this very interesting story in this issue of Big River Magazine, Reggie, about Great Cloud Island, which is actually now two islands, but both of them seem to be being challenged by mining industries, the threat of expansion, and what this might mean for the small community that calls Great Cloud Island home.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. That's mining's been going on there for a long time, actually. And it was one island, but what happened when they built the lock and dam system, most of the locks and dams were built in the 1930s. I have to include the century now. I'm just getting used to it. Anyway, the 1930s, and so they raised the whole point is to raise the level of the water so that there's a 9-foot channel for the towboats. So when you raise the water a foot or two, a lot of land suddenly becomes submerged. Mm-hmm. So that's what happened to Great Cloud Island. What was a lake in the larger island kind of became a channel separating the two islands.
And this is up near the Twin Cities.
Yes, it's up between Cottage Grove and Inver Grove Heights in the Twin Cities, just upstream of Hastings a little bit. And so they've been mining aggregates there, so with sand and gravel, basically, for, I can't tell you when they started, but for, I think, most of the 20th century. And because things like that are very cheap and they're very expensive to haul because they're very heavy, they've been doing most of the shipping by barge from there. So a lot of the construction in the Twin Cities and in that whole area has had sand and gravel from this island. But, of course, as they mine it, it disappears. So that's been happening, and it's of archaeological significance. There was a Dakota community on the island, an Indian community, and it was named after Gray Cloud, who was a woman who lived there in the 1800s.
Oh.
And there were stories that it was haunted. The author of the story grew up, and he lives in Madison now, but by the way, Denny Kniff, he was one of the people that started the River Alliance of Wisconsin. But he grew up in Hastings, and when he was in high school, people were talking about going to the cemetery at Gray Cloud Island at night and seeing ghosts and things like that. And there's a lot of stories associated with that island, and I've paddled around it. Actually, I spent the night in one of the little harbors that's in Gray Cloud Island that was probably created from the mining in a houseboat.
Any ghosts?
I didn't see any.
Yeah.
I didn't go on the island. But there's also a really nice rocky bluff along the west side of the upper island that's a very picturesque part of the river. It's neat, and he did a really nice story on it, and now the mining company wants to, and I mentioned earlier that the river bottom is hundreds of feet of sand and gravel. Mm-hmm. This mining company wants to have a really deep mine, several hundred feet deep in the river bottom, right near the main channel. By the island, they're trying to get the permits for it, and a lot of people are going to oppose that because it may have a big effect on the river and who knows what else, because sand and gravel moves around a lot.
Sure, but ultimately the story may be, as you point out in Big River Magazine, that Gray Cloud could be annexed out of existence if it's not careful.
Yeah.
It could go away.
Yeah, it could go away. I mean, they could. I mean, the whole thing is sand and gravel, basically, really, except for the rocky part on the upper island.
We got a call here from Rachel in La Crosse. Let's go there next. Rachel, good morning.
Good morning. I'm so excited to have gotten through.
Awesome. Welcome.
Yeah, so I live in La Crosse, which, of course, the river is a great part of our city here, and the activities here, and I'm not a fisherman. I like to, get in the water and swim around a little bit, but what we really like to do is look for agates.
Yes.
Now, geologically speaking, they're not in our area because we're in this driftless region, so we find a lot of fossils. However, in your knowledge of the river bottoms, what are some places when you get north of here that you start finding them along shorelines, beaches, whatever?
Great question, Rachel. Reggie, where do we find these agates?
It is a great question, and I wish I had a great answer, Rachel. We did a story many years ago, and I remember Connie Cherba wrote it. And these agates typically are found on Lake Superior. That's where people find a lot of them. But, the glaciers moved a lot of sand. And in fact, a lot of the sand and gravel in the river came from up north and was pushed around by the glaciers. And there are areas on the river where people find agates. I couldn't tell you offhand. I believe if I had that database, I could look it up, and that would be the good thing about having the database. But I believe above Red Wing, up above Lake Pepin,
Okay. There
are places where people find agates. But I wish I could be more specific about it. Unfortunately, without spending a little time on it, I couldn't tell you.
Well, yeah, Rachel, hang tight for that archive of Big River magazines to go online, and in the not-so-distant future, it may just be a few clicks away.
Something on our website, which is at bigrivermagazine.com, and I'll see if I... We have a spreadsheet that lists all the stories and the writers, and I could look up Connie's stories and maybe get that one and see if we can post it.
Rachel, thank you for the call. Reggie McLeod, our guest, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. Its July-August edition is out now with the pictures and the stories of the heart of the main artery that runs through this country and how it pumps the lifeblood through somewhere near wherever any of us are today. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around, and yet it's certainly something worth featuring, celebrating, and arguably keeping clean as well. Wanted to invite you to join us in the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. We'll continue with Reggie next. I'm Lee Rayburn on The Larry Mueller Show. Don't miss tomorrow on Garden Talk here on The Larry Mueller Show. We'll hear about vertical gardening with our one of our favorite guests, Melinda Myers. We'll also take a look at your fertilizer and how to keep it as fresh as possible coming up tomorrow from 11 to 1 here on Garden Talk on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and our guest is the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine with its July-August issue out now. Reggie McLeod joins us, and if you'd like to join our conversation, we invite you to it at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. Reggie, Lee Hendricks was a deckhand on the Mississippi back in 1972, making just $25 a day. But as he points out, you could quickly work your way up to be a captain of a barge for about $40,000 a year in those times, which was some good money back then. And he's got a story about tariffs, embargoes, and towboats on the Mississippi that really captured my attention and sort of ties in where we are now compared to where we were more than 40 years ago.
Yes, and that was Lee's story idea, and I liked it because I knew that a lot of towboat owners were concerned about the tariffs that are being applied to different countries.
Mm-hmm.
And China is one of the main purchasers of grain from the U.S., and much of that grain goes down the Mississippi River in towboats. In fact, if you see a towboat going downriver, those barges that it's pushing are probably full of corn or soybeans, and they probably won't be unloaded until they get down to New Orleans, where they're put on a ship that goes off to another country. So these tariffs are affecting things. And the tough thing is a lot of contracts have already been signed,
mm-hmm.
you know. So a lot of the grain trade has shifted to Brazil and other countries because they can get a better price down there, and they don't have to worry about tariffs because they don't know if there'll be tariffs on the grain when it comes down the river or not, too. So that uncertainty is kind of spreading, and I think a lot of farmers are very concerned about that because they have to make decisions about how much they're going to plant in the winter. You know, they're
right.
figuring that out. And this year looks like a really good year weather-wise for the corn harvest and the bean harvest. And when that happens, the price goes down. So my point is that it's very complex. All the economics of this and the way that the prices shift. And he writes a story about how the people that run the barge lines have to kind of make some decisions. They're making decisions now about the fall. Most of that grain moves, you know, in October and November, you know, is the big rush. And there's a lot of barge traffic in those months. And he draws a parallel to when we had an embargo on trade with the Soviet Union back in the
late 70s.
That was in the late 70s.
Yeah. It was President Carter's grain embargo on the former Soviet Union, and how you can find parallels to that today with the proposed tariffs on China.
Yeah, a lot of people lost their jobs on the river during that embargo. and a lot of deckhands lost their jobs, and boats were idle, and shipping companies went out of business and all of that. So he draws a parallel.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see that, and we won't know how it turns out until, you know, probably the winter. They'll be looking back on it and tallying up the figures and that kind of things. But I don't envy the people that have to make those decisions now. And he also points out that a lot of the people that have to make those decisions weren't alive in the late 70s.
Yes.
So it's all new to them, but some of the old hands in some of these places are thinking about that time a lot, because it's a rough situation to be in.
Well, and to get it from the perspective of a guy who started as a deckhand on the river, I thought was what made this story special and different and gave it a perspective that I wouldn't have found outside this issue of Big River Magazine.
Well, Lee is very experienced. He worked for the Army Corps of Engineers for a while. He was captain of the largest towboat on the river, which is the MV Mississippi for the Army Corps. And besides working on a lot of, you know, just boats pushing barges all over the river and the Ohio River, all the rivers, he's also an excellent writer. He's been writing for us since the early years of the magazine, and he just came out with a book called Peep Light, which has a whole bunch of stories about the river, many of which appeared in Big River Magazine, but also some new ones. And that's a new hardcover book that I've been seeing in bookstores. I was just doing some traveling last week, and I visit bookstores very often, and it was on the shelf.
Peep Light,
and that's the light at the very first barge. See, a tow on the upper river can be 15 barges all tied together, three across and five long. So that's really a long. That's like 1,200 feet. And so the pilot only knows where the front of that barge is at night, on a dark night, because there's a little light right on the end, the peep light. So you kind of follow the peep light, which is a joke. But that's what he's referring to in the title.
Lee Hendricks is the author, and he has been a guest previously on the Larry Mueller Show. Reggie, we've got about a minute and a half left, so I'd be interested in what you are working on going forward for the future issues of Big River Magazine.
Oh, boy. I was just working this morning on a story about the Kickapoo watershed and some of the issues with the flood-controlled structures, some of which washed out in previous flooding, and the community down there is trying to figure out what to do about all of that. And I'm drawing a blank. He shifted me into the last issue, and now I have to look at the...
Well, we're going forward now.
Yes. And we've got stories about forest bathing, which is a type of which is used for treatment, used to help people. It's a therapy now. People spend time in the forest, and not only is it relaxing to draw them out of their everyday lives, but there are actually chemicals in the air in the forest that boost your immune system and that sort of thing.
All right.
There's a good story about a fishing guide, Ted Peck, down by the Iowa-Minnesota border on the river, who has a lot of experience, and he's a real interesting guy. He writes for us, but we had a reporter go out with him and be guided by Ted, and that's really amusing. That's a good story.
Fishing guide Ted Peck, a forest bathing experience in the Kickapoo watershed, all to look forward to in the upcoming issues of Big River Magazine. Editor and publisher Reggie McLeod, thanks as always for joining us today.
Okay. Thank you, Lee.
And by way of full disclosure, we should mention that Big River Magazine is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors. Coming up next hour, we take a look at aging and mental health and how you can keep healthy in every way as you get older. It is possible. Our experts will show us the way. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show.